Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show features my conversation with Edie Mermelstein, an attorney and Holocaust educator. We discuss the recent and troubling rise in anti-Semitism, her family's unwavering work with the Auschwitz Study Foundation, and the importance of keeping stories from the Holocaust alive. Sadly, this episode is more relevant than ever, but I hope it will leave you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. Recent remarks and actions, such as those made by rapper Ye, formerly known as Kanye West, underscore a worrying rise in anti-Semitism in the United States. Today's attacks on Jewish communities have eerie similarities to the rhetoric used by the Nazis during World War II. At a time when survivors of the Holocaust are dwindling in numbers, it is more important than ever that we embrace the mantra, never forget. Since the genesis of the Freedom Writers movement, Holocaust education has been a core tenet of our mission. The Freedom Writers and I have heard directly from Holocaust survivors about their experiences during World War II. These firsthand accounts were a powerful reminder of the atrocities that can occur when hate and bigotry are allowed to go unchecked. After the Freedom Writers graduated from high school, we traveled through Europe to visit several of the places we'd read about together in room 203. We walked the war-torn streets of Sarajevo in Bosnia and up the flight of stairs to Anne's secret annex in Amsterdam. We also toured several Nazi concentration camps in Poland, including Auschwitz-Birkenau, the largest of the Nazi camps where more than 1.1 million people were killed. It was an emotional and eye-opening experience for all of us. The most powerful part of Poland was touring the camps with an Auschwitz survivor, Mel Mermelstein. Mel's 1981 lawsuit against the Institute for Historical Review resulted in the court taking judicial notice that the Holocaust and the gassing of Jews at Auschwitz are indisputable historical facts. Since the Holocaust, Mel and the rest of his family have dedicated their lives to Holocaust education and fighting anti-Semitism, and they continue to do this vital work through the Auschwitz Study Foundation. Today's guest, Edie Mermelstein, is Mel's daughter and an activist in her own right. As a lawyer, Edie has worked on numerous high-profile cases and even appeared before the U.S. Supreme Court. Her work as a Holocaust educator and activist continues the incredible legacy started by her father and honors the memory of her family members who were killed in the Holocaust. Without further ado, here is my courageous conversation with Edie Mermelstein. When I first met your father, the mantra that he taught my students was, never forget and never again. And I'll always remember the story he told us when we visited Auschwitz.
My father, within 5 days, was shipped to the coal mines. And he told me and my brother, we must separate. We must stay apart. Why? Because he knew out of the three of us, perhaps one may survive. He was a realist. If one of you survive, promise me that you will tell the world what they did to us here.
But in 2022, it seems that a lot of people are anti-Semitic or Holocaust deniers or white supremacists. And I think your father would have a really hard time with his life's legacy, realizing that in this day and age, people did forget and genocides are happening yet again. So let's start there about what do you think your father's legacy is all about?
My dad's legacy really is to promote peace and love and understanding and self-awareness. The self-awareness comes from helping people learn that their perceptions may not be true and that they need to go out themselves and seek the truth themselves and educate themselves. He was a big promoter of that. And I think with the Freedom Writers, there was this opportunity to show them firsthand an account that could bring it all together so that there was something tangible. Because I think in today's society and the way that things are ramping up with social media, Twitter, just the way that students learn, we don't have the vetting that we used to have. Now, some of the vetting that we used to have might not have been the best, but there's this Wild West out there, and the loudest voices that seem to be so reprehensible in so many different ways are the ones that are being spotlighted and heard and looked at. And if there's the Holocaust denial and the anti-Semitism pushing it forward, I think my dad's legacy is here to tamper it back and try and help people, especially young minds. My dad was always about teenagers. And I think the teenagers really hit him in his heart because that's when he was actually scooped up and transported to Auschwitz when he was 17 years old. The train that led him to Auschwitz, did they see it coming? Did Germany make it known to the world that this genocide was going to be happening? It was eroding over a decade at least. And so it's the small steps that kind of lead to this aha moment that I think my dad's legacy is, let's have the aha moment before there's another complete catastrophe, a complete genocide. And I often wonder, could it happen here in the United States in 2022?
With that legacy, what would your dad say at a former president's residence, Mar-a-Lago, that a known anti-Semite, yay, formerly known as Kanye West, and a white nationalist, Nick Fuentes, would dine with former President Trump? What would your father say about giving an audience to people who have denied the Holocaust and have used anti-Semitic tropes and stereotypes?
It's really hard for me because I feel like when I look at how my dad debated, you kind of have to have equal time, right? You need to give equal time. So if you have a former president that is focusing attention and giving a spotlight to anti-Semitic personalities, because that's what they represent right now. And I believe that Trump thinks any kind of publicity is good publicity, bad, good, indifferent. He wants to stimulate the machine. It feeds right into it. It's definitely a shame. I don't think my dad would be comfortable and might see the warning signs of something that was happening 70 years ago. I mean, the ramp up, Kristallnacht, all of that happened.
It started
in the 1930s. And my dad was transported to Auschwitz in 1944. And I often wonder, how did a civilized society go from looking at little babies as not human, but rodents that need to be exterminated? How do we get there? How do we dehumanize people, a sect, a religion, a nationality, a color? How do we dehumanize that? It looks like it's a marketing machine, and that's how the Nazis did it. They were really good at marketing and getting kind of nationalism going. And the Jews have traditionally been blamed for a lot of things over the years. And it is worrisome. I think my dad would not be comfortable. If he were here, he'd be right in there standing up and speaking out and wanting to educate and wanting to make sure that people had all the information. So if you're getting only this highlighted peak information of anti-Semitism and look, it's being welcomed, and oh, maybe that's the way I want to go. It's not looking at the core of what my dad's legacy really is, I think, is how do we look at differences and not being so hard-coded in a way that restricts free thought. So I know that my dad always looked to push people out into the universe. That's also giving people the ability now to investigate, and there's so much populated on the internet that I tell students all the time that if you go research my dad at this point, you're going to look at neo-Nazi rhetoric that is not true. It's just like tabloids and celebrities, right? You may read something, there might be something in there that is just completely false, but it's out there. And then a lot of people glob onto it and they're like, yeah, you know, they get onto a bandwagon. I don't know how to really stop that train, but I think it's education. It's certainly empathy. I think empathy is the number one thing that our society needs, to be empathetic to one another. And I think that's something my dad was really good at bringing to students and to just people that he meet.
As a daughter of a Holocaust survivor who sadly passed less than a year ago, your dad was 95. And so for the better part of my adult life, your father was this force to be reckoned with. He called me after I had taken my students to see Schindler's List and subsequently got death threats from my neighbors in Newport Beach. Your father wanted to come to my class and to speak to the Freedom Riders. I'd love for you to talk to our audience about your dad as a teenager, because we have a lot of teenagers in our audience. So can you paint a picture of your dad pre-war as a teenager?
It's funny because I look at my dad in the rearview mirror, and what I see is somebody who was extremely talented and very athletic. It was always amazing to me. He could ice skate like no one, water ski. He played soccer. He enjoyed his friends. It was a different place, though. So certainly not United States 2022. We're looking at Eastern Europe, and the restrictions started coming in. First, for a Jew, they started getting things taken away from them, and schooling wasn't readily available. But he continued to self-teach. And I think he always had such a love of finding out information and gathering knowledge and learning languages and breaking things down. And he passed that along to me in a way that I think helps me in my career.
I remember when your father went with us to Auschwitz, and I just remember being on the trip with him. He spoke German. He spoke Polish. So I remember just in the time that we were in Europe with him, hearing him adapt to an audience, and it was fascinating because his language was spot on in whatever audience we were with.
I think that is such a learning tool. It also opens your brain. Learning languages definitely expands your ability to communicate and to understand and to grasp things.
What was his native tongue?
So it's interesting because he spoke a lot of Hungarian, but that came in later. I think they spoke Yiddish. They spoke Czechoslovakian, but Hungarian seemed to be a very hard-coded language for him when he was in his late stages of decline. He started really reverting back to Hungarian. And so there were times where I didn't know what he was saying, but I knew it was another language and then identified it as Hungarian.
So when he was put on a cattle car, was that in Hungary?
So Czechoslovakia got taken over by Hungary and then didn't give up their Jews to the Nazis at the beginning of the war. They kept them in brickyards. And when you look at different Holocaust survivors' accounts that came from the Hungarian region, all of their stories are very similar because at that point, the Nazis had routinized the death camps to a point where it was an active machine. And if we look at the death camps in the machine age, if you think about what was going on, the machine age started and you were just having a factory. And so what was that factory for? Here it was for killing specifically Jews. And it was made as a factory so that less labor had to do one-on-one killing of Jews because they wanted to kind of spare the Nazis resources in having to do the hard labor of killing. But it was literally a slaughterhouse for Jews. So being transported to Auschwitz was just a direct line to get off the train. They had numbers, they had branding. The Nazis were meticulous at keeping records, which is one of the reasons why we can see so much in the history of what they did. And when my dad was fighting different Holocaust deniers back in the 70s and early 80s, it really was about, oh, this many people didn't die here, only this many, and trying to minimize the numbers or try and do things that put doubt in the historical picture of what was going on in Nazi Germany and beyond, because For example, Auschwitz is in Poland, and the Polish government now is very sensitive to their part in Auschwitz and the Nazi regime, and have made laws trying to make it illegal to say negative, defamatory things about Poland in respect to Auschwitz. It's interesting how time goes by, and certainly the trauma that my dad experienced, he was the sole survivor of his family. So he came out alone. He was 18 years old. So he was only in there for a year, only the unspeakable things that can happen in a year. And he was also on the death march from Auschwitz to Buchenwald, which Buchenwald, they marched them in the snow without shoes. And so when you think about my dad as a teenager, think about an 18-year-old who's 5'10", who at the end of the day when he was liberated was 68 pounds and had typhus and was a skeleton, not expected to live.
You know, the famous picture that a lot of people think about when they see the book Night by Elie Wiesel, your father's in that photograph in the barracks at the concentration camp. What was that like for you to know that your father was in the same barracks as Elie Wiesel?
Elie Wiesel has notoriety and is amazing, and he's just an incredible human being. And I think my dad's experience was very similar to all of those men that were liberated in that bunker. And I think the trauma and the PTSD that they experienced at the core is on the same base level. I think there is a kinship there that Holocaust survivors shared. Most survivors didn't talk so much about their experiences in the camps. They were liberated, but they didn't talk about it. My dad was one of the few that talked about it. Elie was one of the few that talked about it. And Viktor Frankl, he wrote an incredible...
Man's Search for Meaning.
Yeah, Man's Search for Meaning, which at the core, they're all connected.
Sitting between us is your dad's book, My Bread Alone, and it's his account of everything you're explaining about being a teenager and going to Auschwitz and the death march, and also his tattoo number. Do you know what the number on his arm was?
Yes, it was A4685, and that followed him out of the camps. And it's one of the things that I know students and people in general would always want to look. And it's one of the reasons why nobody in my family right now, like my kids, we don't have tattoos out of respect for my dad. He never looked at people that had tattoos and thought, oh, they shouldn't have tattoos. But for him, it wasn't his choice to have a tattoo. And so it was a mark of survival and a remembrance because it was right there and he lost his brother and his dad. They were also all marked. So that was where you could find a lot of data, too. You look and see where the number is.
Your father was so open with you as children. What was that like to be a kid and have your dad explain the tattoo and explain his childhood to you when a lot of people didn't talk about the Holocaust until after Schindler's List?
So it's interesting. He didn't directly sit us down and say, I'm a Holocaust survivor. That wasn't my experience. My experience was watching a father so compelled and so driven that it wasn't a direct communication of his trauma, but it was watching the manifestation of the trauma. And there's one film that is just burned in my memory, and that's Night and Fog. It's a French film. It was put together from Nazi footage. And my dad showed it at the Huntington Beach Central Library in the 70s. And I was 8 years old. And I probably should not have been in that audience because I don't recommend an eight-year-old see the visual imagery that is depicted in the Holocaust. It's too graphic and it hit me at a very deep level. Now, I always knew that something had happened, and I didn't know that other families didn't also have a father who left and went to Europe a couple weeks a year in search of meaning. I mean, really, it was in search of just any shred of things that he could bring back from the exact accounts of his family.
Prior to seeing this film at 8 years old, your father made a pilgrimage every year to Auschwitz and brought things back with him from the actual camp, and it was still under communist regime at that point. So what's the first thing you remember your father showing you returning from Auschwitz?
So it's interesting because going back in my memory, my dad had always been part of something that I didn't really understand. Before I was even born, he had gone to the Eichmann trial, which was in Israel in 1960. And that was something he was compelled to do.
And for our listeners, he was one of the head SS men in charge of the Holocaust and the Final Solution. Is that correct?
Right. That was in Israel, but he would go beyond and go to Germany, and he was able to go to Buchenwald and go to Dachau and go to different death camps that were in the western part of Europe. But the eastern part was still really locked down and under communist regime. But in 1967, that's when he made his first sojourn to Auschwitz, to Poland. And at that point, he got a visa. He had some travel agent making arrangements for him and went back and connected with the caretakers at Auschwitz and basically began collecting things and bringing them back. So that was the jump off point. And what I do remember as a small child, I remember him bringing a very large post that he made into a candelabra, and he ended up at a temple that we had belonged to, had Yom HaShoa, there was a candle lighting ceremony, and they used the post from Auschwitz. He made it into candelabra, and we lit candles, and I said a poem. It was The Last Butterfly. And I think that was about the same time that I started really realizing what had happened. And that's also kind of a culmination of also realizing, wait, I don't have a grandmother or grandfather or cousins or uncles or aunts. They're not there. Because then we started seeing families and we're doing this memorial service. And I start seeing, oh, my dad always lit 5 candles on the fireplace pretty regularly. And so it was one of those things where it just connected at, you know, a young age. But that's when I started realizing, oh, this is different. This is a different level of trauma. And I was always really protective of my father. Although he had a persona out there in the world, I also saw the struggle and the pain when he lit each candle.
He lit those candles for the Freedom Hours when we were at Auschwitz. So he took us to the crematorium where he believes his mother and sister were killed, and also where he thinks he lost his dad and his brothers. Was it a singular brother or?
He had one brother, Lajos, and he had 2 sisters, Etu and Magda. And he actually witnessed when they got off the train, they separated, and he saw his mom and 2 sisters go to the line that ended up where they were cremated in crematorium number 5. So during his sojourns and on the many journeys that he had, he connected with the Auschwitz officials. He started a nonprofit, the Auschwitz Study Foundation. That was a vehicle to be able to bring certain items back. And one of the items that he did bring back is the chute where the gas came into crematorium number 5. I think I didn't understand the significance for a number of years, but it is almost as if he had a murder weapon that killed his family. When you're looking at evidence and you're trying to build a case, certainly if you have the smoking gun or if you have the crematorium chute, it's definitely evidence of a crime. And I think he was adamant about making sure that the Nazis and the people that came after the Nazis, the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists and the Holocaust deniers and the force of hate would not grasp into the hearts and minds of the youth. He wanted to make sure there was evidence so that if he brought a group through his collection, it was there. They could touch and feel and see, and it's hard to deny when it's right in front of you.
No, I think for our audience around the world, it's important to note that you and I live and work in these beautiful seaside communities. We're in Huntington Beach now. You grew up in Long Beach. I was in Newport Beach when I met your father. And to know that Holocaust deniers were amongst us in these beautiful seaside communities, can you talk about the Institute for Historical Review, which your father actually took to task?
He did. So the Institute for Historical Review was originally based in Torrance. They are now situated in Newport Beach. I think that, again, they want to steal a spotlight and shine something that's not true. You could Google my dad's name, and the Institute for Historical Review has a ridiculous story that is absolutely not true, talking about how his parents went to Israel living under assumed names, and it just lies, you know, like ridiculous, easily shown to be ridiculous. But it doesn't mean they're not out there and that they're not still up and that they sound really fancy, Institute for Historical Review. It sounds fancy, but at the core, when you start looking at what's driving it, it's really fear. It's fear-based and it's hate. And getting beyond that, I think they were the ones that really started reaching out and baiting Jews, especially focusing on Holocaust survivors. That was their mission, was to really get under the goat of a Holocaust survivor. The Institute for Historical Review used advertising dollars and advertised in the Jerusalem Post and other Jewish newspapers looking for anyone that could prove that Jews were gassed in gas chambers or turned into bars of soap.
That's audacious.
Right. I think putting those ads in was what caught my dad's attention. He ended up writing a letter to the editor of the Jerusalem Post, calling them out on not only taking advertising dollars, but how absolutely hurtful it is. And from that, the Institute turned it around on my dad and said, we want you personally to prove the Jews were gassed in gas chambers.
You, Mel Mermelstein.
Yes, yes. If you don't, then we're going to publicize to the mass media that you're just here as a Zionist plot, nothing you're saying is true, and we're going to expose you to the mass media. My dad took that as a threat, which it was, and turned it around on them and ended up seeking counsel. So my dad is not an attorney. He didn't have a legal background, but he ended up speaking to a lot of different Jewish organizations, and a lot of people were telling my dad kind of to let it go, like just let it pass. But my dad couldn't just leave that without it being challenged. I think one of my dad's points was always like, if you see something, say something, right? You can't just let it lie, because that's what happened over a decade when the Nazis were gearing up to build manufacturing plants to kill Jews. It's really even ridiculous to think that happened. And that's, I think, now in the current time where Holocaust deniers aren't looking at, oh, the numbers were off and you're over exaggerating. And this is just trying to get sympathy. They're now looking at it like, how ridiculous are you? This is like, how could this even happen? Building factories to kill Jews? It's preposterous, right? They're looking at it to try and make it a joke more than picking at the numbers. But going back to when my dad wrote the letter to the editor and then they challenged him, he ended up seeking counsel from the lawyer's name is William Cox. My mom met him when she was running for school board, and they were both running for school board. And, you know, my mom brought the case to him, brought my dad to him. He looked at it, and this man, William Cox, is a legal strategist like none other. I mean, he just parsed it out, and he was a former sheriff. He really saw the injustice and felt the need and jumped in. And I think at a large cost to him, I know as an attorney, every time you take on a case, especially with the magnitude that this case ended up having, it takes a toll on your practice. It takes a toll on your energy. Because one thing I know is that everybody that's listening has the exact same 24 hours a day as any other person. And it's just, how are you going to spend those 24 hours? And William Cox ended up really going all in, and he worked tirelessly and strategized and ended up filing a complaint. And one of the claims was injurious denial of a historic fact, which opened up the door. So it was also a breach of contract, because once they accepted the offer, the Institute for Historical Review did not want to pay.
And what was the, was there a large bounty? Wasn't it like a
$50,000? It was $50,000 reward.
So they were saying, you have to prove that people were turned into bars of soap and gassed at Auschwitz.
Yeah.
Or you have to pay us $50,000?
No, they were offering a reward. It was basically, if you presented proof to their kangaroo court, so it wasn't in a court of law. And at that point, they were really looked at as fringe. I think that's part of why the whole wanting to keep it quiet, and a lot of people were like, ah, let it go. Don't put gas on the fire. But the thing about putting gas on the fire, sometimes the fire needs to burn. And sometimes we need to understand what's really at the core of something. And so what my dad did with the help of William Cox, and then later, Michael Morocco and his partner Gloria Allred came into the case. So William Cox put forth a motion for judicial notice. So he had a request for judicial notice that Jews were gassed in Auschwitz in the summer of 1944, and presented eyewitness testimony from my dad, as well as other historical pieces of information. And the judge took judicial notice that the Holocaust is simply a fact and that it can't be disputed. And that based on that factual determination, the Institute for Historical Review's case fell apart. And that was really a victory for the Jewish people. It was a victory for my dad. Later in the 90s, Leonard Nimoy, it was his first non-Spock role, and he ended up playing my dad in the movie Never Forget, which focused on the court case. It was a TNT film. And it was nominated for Best Picture at the Cable Ace Awards, because at that time, the Emmys weren't all combined. And I think it was really an accomplishment to hang in there, but it also took a toll on him.
As a lawyer who has presented to the Supreme Court, could this have gone all the way to the Supreme Court? I know this was in the Superior Court of California, but since anti-Semitism is so rampant right now, is this something that might need to go all the way to the Supreme Court?
The tracks to the U.S. Supreme Court are interesting. If you're in state court in California and then you appeal, there's a district court. In Los Angeles, it would go to the Second District Court of Appeal. If they would have ruled against the Institute for Historical Review, the Institute for Historical Review could have sought review at the California Supreme Court. And the California Supreme Court doesn't have to take everything that comes to them. If they would have denied or not taken the case for review, that's the path. Then if your Supreme Court or your highest court of a state doesn't want to look at an issue, you can then do a cert up to the U.S. Supreme Court. But the U.S. Supreme Court takes so few cases that it's very rare for a case to go all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. There's some direct tracks, not to give a civics lesson, but I keep thinking about my journey to the Supreme Court was through the state court. It was really interesting because there are only about 80 to 85 cases that get heard a year. And there's thousands and thousands of cases that are trying to get review at that level. It just depends. A judicial notice is an established fact. It really means that something is so concrete that to deny it is unlawful.
So when you see young men in khakis with tiki torches at Charlottesville saying, Jews will not replace us, what does that do to your psyche? Because your father was still alive when that happened. And your father was still someone who wants to stand up and speak out. What was that like to see that imagery in a college town in America and a then president say they were fine people.
That was very difficult. Definitely earth-shattering in a lot of ways, triggering, traumatizing, and it shouldn't have happened. So fine people don't try and dehumanize other people. Regardless of who says what, at the end of the day, you have to look at where's this message coming from? And then fight against the message and speak out against the message in whatever appropriate way there is. It's troubling and it's all fear-based and it's all hate-driven. So the only thing that can counter that is love for one another and to look beyond it. And it's really troubling. Just a lot of things in the United States to me are very troubling today.
For your father to have been so bold and so public, there was also death threats. Can you talk about that? Because we as freedom riders tried to follow in his footsteps and we too got death threats and we were attacked by the KKK. So what was that like as a kid, knowing that your father was notorious for being a fighter, but also what that must have been like behind the scenes being very scared of, are any of these threats a reality?
I tried never to grab onto fear. There was something about it that I tried to protect my dad because I think he would worry about us. I have three brothers and myself and my mom. But at the same time, not that I thought I was invincible, but there was a certain, I stand in my two shoes. I stay aware of my surroundings and life happens. If we live in fear all the time, I can't do it. And my dad was courageous on a number of fronts and he taught that courage and that sense of justice and sense of speaking out. And I carry that on in my practice. I know that I take cases that are hard. I'm generally representing the vulnerable, the people that can't speak for themselves. And I think he instilled that courage in me. So rather than being fearful and scared or worried about death threats, it was a way of living without fear. And so it helps you step off the cliff and you have to move forward. My dad survived Auschwitz. He survived a death march. If he was scared to take that first step, he wouldn't be here and I wouldn't be here.
Your father took the Freedom Riders to Auschwitz and also to another death camp, Hilmno, where they asphyxiated people in vans and then disposed of the bodies in the forest. And I just loved your father being a tour guide, but also this incredible historian. So what was it like for you the first time your dad took you to Auschwitz?
I only went once and I was in ninth grade and we traveled with another father-daughter and the father had never been back since he was liberated. And so he was going through a huge emotional turmoil and you've traveled with my dad to Poland and to Auschwitz. If there's a red velvet rope and you're not supposed to go behind it, he's behind it and knows where everything is. And so it was very eye-opening. And I know that he took me to one spot where he knew it was like a killing field. And there was just a femur bone. In it. That time, that was 1979. It was still very raw. There's a lot of rawness there. You feel something when you're on the soil. It's just intense. It's an intensity that I didn't realize I was going to experience.
Until recently, your father had a museum and you have curated this museum for a new location. But what was it like as a child, a teenager, and then a lawyer to know that your father had taken these artifacts from Auschwitz with permission to create art and meaning?
I think that his pieces represent so much, and I know over the years it was a cathartic process. So to watch him lay out different pieces and take barbed wire and put it into different figures or spoons of victims or forks, it was something that grounded him and allowed him, I think, to commune with the victims. So the people that didn't make it back, I think it was his way to honor them and to put forth something that was a creation of just this decimation of his family.
I think the Star of David series he did is my favorite. So can you talk about all the art that your dad made with these articles, the barbed wire and the spoons, and how he tried to create something beautiful out of something so horrific?
I don't know if he ever thought of it as actual art or beauty. I think it was his process. And through the process, the Star of David meant so much to him. He didn't want it relegated to a yellow star that he had to wear to mark him as a Jew. The Star of David means so much. And there is beauty in it, but there's also pain in it that's expressed in his pieces. So I think that's another aspect of it.
In your dad's museum, there was Zyklon B, and there was this wonderful teaching moment where your dad would take students, as did you, through the lessons of history and point out all of these moments that led progressively to the death camp. So what was that like to know that your dad had in his possession Zyklon B and some of these other artifacts, like you said, the chute and the actual murder weapons? What was that like to know that your dad had that in his museum?
I always felt a little bit like a gatekeeper, and we were always very protective of the items. Definitely the local police and the local fire department, everybody knew what my dad had amassed. And then people would come, Huntington Beach High School, for example, would roll their buses in and go through the museum. And it was at a pallet yard. So it was really kind of under the ropes. At this point, part of the collection is at Jewish Newport. And we're starting to have schools come through. And it really is a teaching tool. I think what my dad created is a very rich, guttural teaching tool that is not duplicated anywhere I've seen it. It's much different than a typical museum. It's more something that can propel people to seek the truth. And I think that's what he wants. It, in a way, has its own beauty. And I hope it's there for decades to be able to be a teaching tool.
If your dad was here today and he heard what Kyrie Irving was perpetuating with this horrific film, or what Ye has been putting out on Twitter by saying he wants to go DEFCON 3 on the Jews, or even Nick Fuentes, who is a known white supremacist, I feel like your dad would pick up the phone and call them. I feel like your dad would pick up the phone and invite them to his museum. What do you think your dad would say if they responded or actually came to his museum?
Well, I think he'd open the door and he would try and connect and figure out what's at the core of the hate and the fear. And how can it be healed? And I think he would pick up the phone. I do. And then you'd see if there was resistance or not. Because there's something at the core. There's something driving this. Are Jews just a scapegoat? I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me to speak to what my dad would say. Because he just had a way. And I don't have that same way that he has. I was always marveling over how he could just debate and put things right.
So your legacy to your dad is going to be this incredible documentary. So what is that like to take all this archival footage of your dad and to make a masterpiece?
It's pretty difficult because when I started the project, my dad was still alive. And during the course of production, he passed. And I didn't know it was going to hit me that hard. And not that I didn't know. And I know he was 95, so he lived a long life. But certainly, every time I see him on the screen, it's just...
He's so vibrant.
He's so vibrant. He's so alive. And his words are there. It's really an honor to be able to curate his words. And I'm so glad that we have so much footage. And then we have interviews and we've actually interviewed a couple of just amazing perspectives. Piecing it together has been an honor. It's a lot of work. And we've been working on it over a decade.
We worked on ours for 20 years. You got 10 more years if you want.
I know. And I'm saying I just have worked on it for 10 years. The footage, some of the footage is from the 60s and 70s. And when it comes together, it's going to be right. And at this point, I'm just honored to be able to help shepherd it along. You know, that's all you can really do.
Before there was the documentary, there was the film that you mentioned. So what was it like to have Mr. Spock, Leonard Nimoy's playing your father, and Gwyneth Paltrow's mother, Blythe Danner, played your mom? What was that like? Did your dad have any say in who played him, or how did that come to?
Well, Leonard Nimoy picked it up and approached my dad and wanted specifically to have a script written and to play him. So it wasn't who would play him. Leonard had already decided he wanted to play my dad. And he did an excellent job. I mean, he studied my dad down to every mannerism, and it was really interesting watching him work. And he spent time with my dad and really tried to get the essence. And they filmed some of it at the Palette Company. And it was certainly an exciting time.
As a young teacher, I was blessed to meet your father and other Holocaust survivors here in Southern California. And ever since, for nearly 30 years, your father and other survivors have been part of my curriculum. And I'm saddened that after the pandemic, a lot of survivors stopped speaking for fear of the virus. And many of them are now in their 90s. And your father died at 95. So as a teacher, I'm nervous. What's it going to be like in 10 years from now or 20 years from now for teachers using this subject in their class if they don't have a survivor to come and speak to them? What will that be like in the future?
It's really daunting, and I know my dad thought a lot about it. One of the things that I'm thankful for is the push in the 90s, the Shoah Foundation that was spearheaded by Steven Spielberg. They went out and started collecting oral history projects and just did oral interviews with survivors, collected and amassed so many of them. Then they took it upon themselves and did even more advanced technology and put them in holographs. And I think that project is really going to be valuable. It's otherworldly to think that you could sit down across from a Holocaust survivor who's a holograph, and there's prompts so that you could ask a question and they'll respond to the question. So the amount of technology that was used, I want to credit the Shoah Foundation because it's an amazing gift to the teaching world and the world at large. And then there's written stories, and there's a lot of material out there. I don't think it doesn't substitute for getting to meet someone who survived, touch their arm, see the actual tattoo. That's gone. And it's the people that are survivors today, most of them were children survivors, and it's definitely a dwindling population. So it is sad. And I know my dad would have wanted to live longer. Unfortunately, he died of COVID. So at the end of the day, the virus took him, and that really was sad. I hate that. I know. I really do hate that.
As a teacher, we've seen images of red Solo cups in the form of a swastika in Newport Beach. We've seen tiki torches and khakis at Charlottesville. We've heard basketball stars and rappers say some pretty horrific things. So what would you say to the youth if they were to witness a swastika etched on a locker, to hear anti-Semitic tropes in a hallway, or to see it on a social media feed? What would you tell the youth that they are capable of doing when they see horrific things?
I think that it's really important to understand that even as one person, you can make a difference, and that calling it out and reporting things and not sitting idly by, you have to be courageous to be able to stand up. But I think it's the right thing to do, and it can create a better environment, because if you start allowing that kind of hate to bleed over into just being normalized, that's when you're going to have issues where safety comes into play. And I really feel for students in this particular period of history where they have to have fear that there could be a school shooting or there could be somebody that's going off the rails. And I think that taking it at its core and looking at speaking up and trying not to just stand idly by, joke about it, let it be okay, and normalizing, don't normalize this kind of anti-Semitic or racial or religious hate. You cannot normalize it. It's not normal. It's just not normal.
I'm so grateful to Edie for sharing with us her family's story and the importance of Holocaust education. My dear listeners, may we perform the necessary work to keep the story of the Holocaust alive. May we commit ourselves to stand up, and speak out against anti-Semitism and bigotry in all its forms. And in honor of today's guest, Edie Mermelstein, may we all strive to be the upstanders in the fight for justice. That concludes our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and thank you for being part of our Freedom Writer family. If you'd like to learn more about the Auschwitz Study Foundation or the upcoming documentary about Edie's father, Mel, Live to Tell, please go to the episode description in your podcast app and click on the links in our show notes. Once again, I'm your host, Aaron Gruel. This episode was produced and edited by Rob Falk. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.